We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
You got Matt Miller on all the time.
Matt Miller.
Here I come. You ready?
Lead NFL and NFL draft analyst at Bleacher Report.
In NFL, you need guys who have upside and potential, and you have to have something that kind of makes you special.
The Stick to Football Podcast.
We ain't got to talk about too much. We're just having fun and we're working, baby. That's it.
Going through college and NFL film.
You need to be just an MF-er out there where you're going to put this guy on the ground every play.
Matt Miller with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Matt Miller evaluates talent, watches football, has thoughts, joins us now. He is at NFL Draft Scout on Twitter. He of Bleacher Report is on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. Matt, what's going on?
What's up, boys? Good to talk to you again.
You too. We got a week of college football on the books now, and there's been film to watch. There's been players in action. What's at the top of your notebook?
Yeah, man. I'm excited to see what happens tonight, obviously, now that we have some real NFL football, but so much of my life now revolves around the college game. And so I think it's, you know, taking what we saw last week, team like OU comes out red hot, absolutely just, you know, goes daddy mode on FAU. So I want to see how they bounce back against UCLA, if Chip Kelly can get something going there. I mean, Iowa Hawkeyes, you got the rivalry game against Iowa State this week. I mean, there's a great slate of college games that we got to get through first. But, I mean, I am pretty excited for some NFL football. I mean, I want to see Khalil Mack hit Aaron Rodgers a couple of times. I'm sure you guys are excited for that too. So there's just like, it's one of those weeks where starting tonight, man, I'm going to be planted on my couch drinking beer and eating barbecue for 4 days. So I'm in heaven.
We had three quarterbacks in the college game going up against each other, at least on the schedule in week one. It was Browning, it was Stidham, and it was Greer for Washington, Auburn, and West Virginia. I thought Greer made the most NFL throws. I thought Stidham was fine. And I thought Browning got put in some bad spots by his offensive coordinator with some weird play calls and some ugly stuff. I wonder what you thought of those three, you know, three regarded as some of the best college quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on that. Will Greer looked amazing. I had one of the best weekends of anyone in college football, regardless of position. And to take on a Tennessee team, it's not a Tennessee team that we all grew up watching,
Mm-mm.
or at least you and I. I mean, I don't know if Tennessee had football when Dan grew up, but there's still athletes out there. Greer was making some amazing plays. I think with Jake Browning, one of the problems that we're going to see with him all year, guys, is that he's going to get put in spots where he doesn't have the arm strength to get out of those holes. You know, we talked all last year about what makes Josh Allen great. It's he has the arm strength that's going to get him out of these tight spots, and we don't see that with Browning. So I think that's a big question. Stidham, I think, was like Stidham's numbers weren't as good as Will Greer's, and they weren't as good as Dwayne Haskins at Ohio State. But what he did against a Washington secondary that has two players that are thought of as first-round picks, Taylor Rapp, the safety, and Byron Murphy, the corner, those are first-round picks. And Stidham came out it was definitely hotter earlier than he was toward the end of the game. I think Washington did a good job adjusting a little bit and slowed them down. But I thought he looked like a potential top 10 pick or quarterback. He reminds me so much of Mitch Trubisky, and I think I've compared him to Tony Romo even. Like, you know, he has that athletic kind of not, you know, these 6'5", 200-pound frame. You know, he's kind of a compact guy who's got a strong arm, is very, very good on the move, and is more athletic than a lot of people think. So I think Stidham's someone that everyone in NFL circles will start to pay a lot more attention to.
Was I crazy, or does Washington have another cat quick 300-pound nose tackle who was all over the field?
They do. Greg Gaines. And, man, he was getting great push. And he's someone we knew about last year. You were aware of him when you're watching Vita Vea and all the talent they had on defense last year. I mean, they had two linebackers that a year ago we thought were going to be draftable players. And they both got into injuries and a little trouble, and that pushed them off the board. But, yeah, they have another guy who you have to account for, and he's just like one of those all-motor guys
yep.
where it's like, how the heck do they keep finding these dudes? And they do. Number 99 for Washington is definitely somebody that everybody in the Pac-12 is going to worry about.
Yeah, I'm not the quality of scout that you are, but sometimes when you see something that size moving that quickly and taking good angles, I'm thinking, oh boy, they did it again.
Yeah. And the push for him is so impressive. And that's like, you know, you can look at someone like Puna Ford last year who went undrafted out of Texas, made the Seahawks roster. I think he and Greg Gaines are really similar guys because they're not going to fit, you know, all the metrics that you're going to throw out there. Oh, we want a guy who's this tall and this, you know, runs a three cone of this time and has this long of arms. But when you just watch football every Saturday, like it's going to be impossible to not notice that guy and realize that, okay, he's really good at this. You know, what we're asking him to do, there's got to be a fit for him in the pros. So he's not going to be one of those, you know, first-round draft picks, but he's definitely a guy that is going to make a ton of plays.
What did you see and not see in Michigan versus Notre Dame?
Oh, my God. I didn't see Jim Harbaugh coach. I want to apologize to any of you, and I know you have a big Notre Dame audience there. I was so wrong about this game. Oh, my God. I thought that losing Harry Highstead and losing McGlinchey and Quentin Nelson, it was just going to be devastating. And it was the Michigan offensive line that wasn't any good. I mean, they did nothing. And there's been hype for 3-4 months about Shea Patterson, the savior of Michigan football. Man, I didn't see it. And I know week one, you can't make huge assessments about that. But in college football, you lose week one, and that could be your whole season could be gone, especially in the Big Ten where there's so much competition this year. Especially, like, look at how great Ohio State looked or Wisconsin looked. Mm-hmm. Michigan is, gosh, they might be the fourth or fifth best team in the Big Ten right now, which is insane considering you have this coach that's supposed to be amazing. You bring in a grad transfer quarterback who's supposed to be the best thing you've had there since Tom Brady, and they look flat. I mean, the defensive line did a pretty good job, but I think a lot of credit has to go to Notre Dame. Brandon Wimbush looked light years better than the last time I saw him play ball defensively. Man, they were so aggressive. Jerry Tillery had one of the best games of anyone this weekend and didn't get enough recognition for it, I don't think. So Notre Dame, yeah, hats off to Brian Kelly, man. I definitely deserve. We actually have a bet on the podcast this week. I think I have to get a Notre Dame tattoo just in shame, or I have to get slapped in the face. So you might want to pay attention to that. I would prefer to be slapped in the face.
Oh, yeah, take the slap. Yeah, you want
to say. I mean, that's going to hurt for 5 minutes. The Notre Dame tattoo is on me forever.
Yeah,
so,
that's forever shame.
It's bad, though. It was that bad that I feel like I owe penance to the Notre Dame fan base.
Matt, I was going to ask if anybody's tape really popped and kind of unexpectedly this week. Maybe Tillery's the answer. I know locally and in the lid lifter, we saw Northwestern play against Rondale Moore and Purdue. Maybe Moore's not on the radar because he is a freshman, right? True freshman. But whose tape really kind of jumped out and you didn't think had what he did?
It's honestly Dwayne Haskins for me, not to make it an all Big Ten show with you guys today, but he was someone where I think over the summer you just heard so much hype, and not just from people at Ohio State, you know, from the recruiting experts who were like, no, this kid was great in high school, and everything we've heard from practice is he's going to be a stud. And it was like, man, I watched JT Barrett play early last year, and he looked awful.
Yeah.
So how good can this Haskins kid be if he couldn't get on the field then? Well, it turns out he's really good, and they just didn't want to put him on the field for maybe because JT Barrett had been there for 8 years. But Dwayne Haskins was phenomenal. And a lot of people are going to say, okay, man, they beat Oregon State. Who cares? But things like ball placement, velocity, processing, getting through your reads on time, and then just overall athletic ability, that stuff's going to show up no matter who you play. Whether you're playing Alabama or Oregon State or Texas, like that stuff's going to show up. And I think Haskins – week one performance, man, he has to be a Heisman candidate. He has to be, you know, we have to start thinking about him as a potential one and done draft prospect that he can keep that pace
wow.
up all year.
Yeah,
it's crazy. He looked that good.
So we've got football tonight in Philadelphia, the Falcons at the Eagles. We had just talked with Mike Florio about how they're going to call the new helmet rule. I'm fascinated to watch what happens with kickoff returns, when the ball is returned, what the strategy is going to be, because in the preseason, I don't think there was one that was returned more than 60 yards. Mm-hmm. The actual that play might be going away, and teams are going to start to figure out how they're getting it all blocked up. What else are you looking for? What sort of bellwethers are you looking for the first NFL game?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with Florio. If you watched college football over the weekend, I don't know how many games we saw where there were two games where on the opening kickoff there was a scary injury where someone had to be carted off. There were so many targeting penalties called. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be interesting to see, does that carry over to the NFL side where we've heard, okay, they're not going to be as crazy as they were in the preseason. I want to see that. And then just in tonight alone, I want to see if the Eagles are really a front-running team. Are they really the best team in the NFC, or did they just like catch lightning in a bottle last year in beating the Patriots and making that great run to the Super Bowl? And can Nick Foles repeat the little bit of success or a lot of success that we saw in a little bit amount of time from him last year against an Atlanta defense that's going to be pretty rowdy? I mean, they're going to get after you. They have cover corners. They have that pass rush. They can get you from the inside with guys. So that's going to be a lot of it to me is, were the Eagles just kind of a perfect storm last year, or is this a team that we have to consider as one of the best in the NFL now?
Well, that's kind of the crazy thing to me when it comes to the Eagles is – is Nick Foles a guy that you can make changes with, or do you just do what he did, specifically the things he did to get you where he got you during the postseason last year? Because they expect to go back to Wentz. They expect to be able to do the things, all the multiple things he's able to do in that offense. Foles, the playbook is, if not playbook, then skill set is different and has to be managed as such. I don't know how multiple you want to be with a guy you know is only going to be there for 2 weeks, and that maybe makes Atlanta's job easier.
Yeah, I think so. And the like crazy thing about Foles, right, is like we've seen this before. Like, we saw him have that year where he was like 27 touchdowns and four picks with Chip Kelly, and you're like, oh, they have a franchise quarterback. And then the next year he came out and he looked like his arm had fallen off and he had, you know, been hit too many times. And so it's like, all right, which guy are we going to get? Are we going to get the guy who had all that confidence last year down the stretch, or now is it, okay, every mistake I make, I'm looking over my shoulder wondering if Carson Wentz is healthy and going to trot out on the field? I think the job of a quarterback, especially one that's had an up-and-down career like Foles, is so different when, okay, Carson Wentz is hurt, and Nate Sudfeld's not taking the job, man. So just go out there and play loose and have fun, and if we win, no one expects us to. Now, you're the defending Super Bowl champions. There's a hell of a lot of pressure on Nick Foles. There's a lot of pressure on that entire team now to come out and ball out and beat a really good Atlanta team. I think psychologically, and it's a completely different job for him tonight than it was last year. I mean, even headed into the Super Bowl, it was just no one expected us to be here. Let's just play fast and loose, and we're going to, you know, run the Philly special and you know, draw up all these wicked blitz packages and go get the Patriots. And if it happens, it happens. I think now you got a target on your back. It's a lot different.
So, Matt, I'm watching whatever game Herb Street was doing this last weekend, and he kind of – He mentioned the RPO as an offensive play in and of itself and kind of whiteboarded it some for college football fans, which I thought was a little odd because of the prevalence of RPOs in both college and football. But then I started thinking, that's affecting more than just the way we watch offenses. It's affecting the way, you know, defenses scout, the way they recruit, and the way they draft. Is there a specific skill set that the prevalence of RPOs has kind of selected for defensively? Like if you're trying to stop a team that you know or in your division is going to run a bunch of those, or maybe even in your conference in the collegiate game, what one skill set, if there is one, helps stop that more than anything else?
Well, I think it's just athleticism at the linebacker and safety positions are big. But you know, you talk to a lot of defensive players, and it just based on the different stories I worked on over the summer, you know, you're talking to a ton of players, and sometimes you just, hey, we're going to talk about eight different topics because I'm working on all these stories. I don't know any defensive player who feels like the RPO is around to stay. A lot of guys feel like it's – do you remember like when Kaepernick came around and the NFL was like, oh, there's running quarterbacks, and we're going to ask these guys to run, you know, almost like the spread option in the NFL. And the next year at the scouting combine, people are asking Matt Barkley, hey, can you run the option? You know, can you be this type of quarterback? And it fizzled out pretty quickly. A lot of guys on defense feel like that's the RPO is just like a trick. It's not a, you know, like you said, it's not a quote unquote play. It's just a way to kind of keep defenses honest, and defenses will adjust to it. And, you know, these guys are going to have to go to something else. And so I don't know if it's going to be this league defining, you know, moment where, oh man, we need linebackers who are, you know, like Roquan Smith would be a great example of someone who would be good for that. You know, you need linebackers who are not only quick and can change direction and you know, be able to take on an inside and outside run at the same time, basically, but guys who are really, really intelligent to where they can sniff that out. I mean, I think that's what would make someone like Roquan Smith, Reuben Foster when he's on the field. Those are the types of guys who are going to be ideal for that. But I think it remains to be seen if it's going to be something that really shifts the way that we evaluate players.
Yeah, I'm not sure what, because we know that when the read option stuff got popular, Russell Wilson was doing it and Kaepernick was doing it, and the response is, okay, we're going to kill the quarterback no matter what.
Yeah,
and you can do your little scrape exchange, and you can, but the quarterback is going to be hurt, and if a team wants to expose its most important and expensive player to that all the time, go ahead, we're just going to take him out. The response to an RPO, I'm not quite sure exactly what a defense can decide to do other than just blow up the mesh point every single time and just ruin the play. You still got to get there. You know, somebody has to get into a gap or beat a guy to do that. So from a coaching perspective, is there an automatic response to the trick of the RPO?
Well, I think you can man up is the biggest thing. You know, and you could just say, all right, but kind of like you said, we're going to go destroy the quarterback and blow up the mesh point, and let's see how many quarterbacks get hurt doing this. We're willing to take that chance. So I think that is the key for this, is offenses are getting a bit of an advantage because they are able to pause defenses a little bit because, oh, we have to think about where the ball's going. If you man up, you don't have to do that because, I got my guy anyway. So I think that's definitely one way to do it. Some defensive lines might try to two-gap where each defensive lineman is responsible for, you know, his left and right shoulder, and you're almost pausing at the snap there to make a read. That's one way to do it. But if I were a defensive coordinator, and not to go all Greg Williams on anyone, but I would just say hit the quarterback in the mouth every play, and we'll make this stop real quick because no matter what team you are, even if you don't feel like you have a great starting quarterback, you don't want him hit over and over again. And that's one bad thing about the RPO from a quarterback perspective is you're a runner as long as you have that ball in your hand. So you're going to get smacked in the face a little bit.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, appreciate it, guys. Have a good time.
That is Matt Miller at NFL Draft Scouts.
It's all kinds of football.
Now,
you know what I'm doing? You know, because the reason I asked the question is because the Bears theoretically are going to run a whole bunch of RPOs with Mitchell Trubisky and Matt Nagy's offense, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the Packers' injuries at linebackers and how many guys aren't playing for them.
Bears only listing two names?
Mm, that felt good.
I don't know what that says about Roquan Smith or about.
He's fine, damn it.
Leonard Floyd or anybody.
He's fine, damn it.
Not even listed, right? Isn't that what it says?
Yes.
They're all good. They're all
listed.
Fine.
They're all set. They're all ready to roll.
This is your place for Bears and Packers excitement and NFL excitement as well. When we come back, birthday wishes to the only player in Cubs history with 50 doubles and 40 home runs in a season.
I know that man.
Do you know who it is?
I do.
He's celebrating a birthday.
And he deserves a birthday wish.
The only player in the history of the Chicago Cubs with 50 or more doubles and 40 or more homers in a season.
We'll get to that when we come back. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Derek Lee drives that ball. Is it going to carry? It is still going. And it's out! A home run for Derek Lee.
Happy 43, D. Lee, one of the nice guys on some teams in there that, after experiencing some Dusty Baker teams that didn't have a whole lot of nice guys on there. He was always fun to be around. Derek Lee's 43. He's the only player in Cubs history, thanks to Chris Kampka for this, with 50 or more doubles and 40-plus home runs in a season in 2005.
That would be 50 doubles, 46 round-trippers, 199 hits. That led the league. So did his .335 batting average, his .662 slugging percentage.
How about his .418 on-base average,
yep,
and a weighted runs created plus of 170?
Do you know where he finished in MVP voting in 2005?
Sixth.
Third, actually. Okay. Things worked out okay, given the voting. I was just kind of looking through this. Albert Pujols won.
Third.
And he won going away. He had quite a thing going on there, Pujols' 05 season. Andrew Jones finished second with less wins above replacement than Derek Lee. 1 point, exactly. 6.7, 7.7. But you've got Jones' defense and the highlight plays that he's making. I can understand the votes. You know who got jobbed that year?
Who?
Chase Utley. finished 13th, 7.3 wins above replacement, had a whole bunch of numbers aside, 24 dingers and 102 runs batted in, 31 stolen bases. Remember, that's a sprightly Chase Utley in 2005. He finished 13th in that list. Morgan Ensberg managed a fourth-place finish.
And while I have it in front of me, that number, 7.3 wins above replacement, jogged a mental note in my head
Did
that
it.
I was going to do this. Because I want to play with you for the moment, amid all of our football talk here that is going to continue with Jeff Perlman in just a few minutes.
Oh, good.
Amid this, let's play Name That Player, a game we play so often as we play Name That Player. This player currently has that same number of Fangraphs wins above replacement at 7.3.
Right now, this season?
Right now, already this season, wow. He has accrued 7.3 wins. He's batting .298, on base .399, slugging .557, a weighted on base average of .406, a WRC plus of .165.
German Brushrod.
That's it. That's your man's.
That's a guess, German Brushrod.
That is your man's.
No, but this is someone who is perhaps not top of mind in all of our discussions about any number of Mookie Betts, Jose Ramirez, Mike Trout, Francisco Lindor, Matt Chapman.
Those were all AL players. Is this man an AL player?
That's coincidental.
Oh, interesting.
Coincidental. But yes.
but yes,
it is, because this is the year of the AL player atop these leaderboards, because we do have sort of one-sided hitting leaderboard here. After an update,
got me hanging.
Reveal who this might be.
Norm Van Gelier.
It is a Mawashi, right?
Norm Chandelier.
I think so.
No.
I hope my recall.
Sumo wrestling garb.
I believe it's called the big thing around their waist is the Mawashi.
Yes, it is a Mawashi.
Right?
I don't know where the emphasis goes, what syllable it's on, but it's Mawashi.
Okay,
yeah.
Or I just swore in Japanese.
It's
and
the
didn't
loincloth.
It.
The,
right.
Yeah, it's the...
I'm allowed.
Yeah, you are allowed. All right, give me the list of guys that you already, at the top already, these AL players you've been, because I think I may be able to name this player.
All right, I'm going to tell you who this is not.
Okay.
This slash line of .298, .399, .557, 7.3 wins above replacement. It is not Mookie Betts,
okay.
Jose Ramirez,
no.
Mike Trout, Francisco Lindor, Matt Chapman, not Manny Machado, not Matt Carpenter, not J.D. Martinez, not Lorenzo Cain, not Javier Baez, or Christian Yelich.
Okay, so just via the teams that you did mention and haven't mentioned, you don't have an Astro on there? So I'm going to go ahead and guess that it is the Astros' best player right now, because you didn't say out to. I'm going to go with Bregman.
It's Alex Bregman.
Yeah, give me Bregman.
Nice job. That was well done. And I'm just looking at the Fangraphs wins leaders here, and indeed.
Let me open up that whole list.
Yeah, Jose Altuve this year is well down from his peak at 4.1 wins, 28th in between Xander Bogaerts and Trey Turner, but man, Alex Bregman is killing it. He's at the you-cannot-throw-him-a-strike mode of hitting right now because
it's
all barreled up.
He's also played 22 games at shortstop this season. A lot at third, almost all of them at third, and gets to the outfield every now and again for a switch or for a shift or something like that, because Houston will do that. 22 games at short. I mean, we were just talking about the versatility that Javi Baez has in playing shortstop and the offensive season he's put together being as available at shortstop as he's been. And by the way, we talked to Joe earlier this week. Mullin Haw talked about it a bit this morning. Given what you've seen defensively from Daniel Murphy, given what you've seen defensively from Addison Russell his last time out at short and Javi Baez out there at short, I think you're really getting close to having Javi Baez as starting shortstop into the playoffs, aren't you?
Yeah. Yes.
I think that gives you your most versatility. And if the Cubs have erred toward anything, if they've got a track record for anything, it's that kind of versatility, because what it allows you to do is move Javi over to second base for Murphy late after he's got his three ABs. He's leading off like we talked about, so that means he's getting them earlier. Addison Russell comes in at shortstop. that's likely your best defense, assuming Russell gets things ironed and his shoulder is cool. That's your setup, right? That's your setup.
It has to be. And somehow Addison Russell, through a combination of ineffectiveness and injury, is not as trustworthy as he needs to be. And Daniel Murphy, if you can give him a big fishing net or something, what should we
can't get
we,
the net?
Get
the net.
Get him something. Like Harry Carey's old net that yes. he used to have. Just get Daniel something.
And Farmer's net that he asks for during broadcasts all the time.
Or the Max Patkin cartoon giant glove. Is there something we can do?
You think that would help?
It's really the feet.
He'll get to more, but then he's got to find it in that big gargantuan mitt.
And then turn.
The turning's not happening.
Turning and throwing and
maybe
it's so
maybe
bad.
Maybe if the mitt's really big, he's able to tag second base. You know, start double plays that way. You know, if it's like a 4-foot mitt, that means his reach is longer, right? All you got to do is tap second base with a little bit of mitt.
Or cover him with stick'em, Velcro or something.
Yeah, like a Yadi Molina thing where the ball just bounces onto the chest protector.
Right.
Just kind of stays there.
It just kind of pulls it off. And actually, now that we're talking about Alex Bregman, I was thinking about this too. Does he take the high holidays off?
I don't know.
I don't know if it's like, because Sandy Koufax and Hank Greenberg had that come up. There's a handful of guys now.
Sean Green as well.
I
always forget Sean Green.
Did. I believe he did.
He did and then didn't, I think. I think he had done both. He got the dispensation for like a playoff game or something like that.
That's the Hank Greenberg dispensation.
When he was hitting his, I think the season he had 54, he didn't play. And that was kind of a big deal. I'm pretty sure that's right. It's for the Dodgers.
I guarantee you he gets to watch Bears-Packers on Sunday night, though, in real time. No matter where, even maybe during the game. God, it's killing me!
He needs to? You think he's in for that?
I don't know.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to watch.
He could if
you
he wanted to.
I'm just going to be beside yourself.
I know. I'm going to watch it later, though. This is making me crazy.
It's a good text from the 815. Daniel Murphy needs Tony Campana's glove.
Yes.
That man had a glove the size of his torso.
Yeah, that was an all-timer. It was Brett Butler that caused the glove measuring. It was like the Taliban beard measurers came out.
I'm sorry. This is just a giant, giant beard. And your glove's too big, too, so we're going to measure these.
Yeah, it was Brett Butler who was using the giant glove. And then the biggest I had seen since then was that on the hand of Tony Campana. But also it's relative to the size of Tony Campana. It's like when you show up in an 8U game and there's the kid using his brother's glove.
Was Tony Campana on the same team? Because I was thinking about when we mentioned Derek Lee's birthday, right? That was the first athlete that I remember going up to and being really impressed with, like as a professional reporter at the time, because that was that first Cubs clubhouse I went into while I was working with the Score.
Right.
And I saw him and he was Derek Lee and he's huge and just ripped out of his mind and just, you know, really making thoughtful responses to a whole bunch of questions when everybody else in that clubhouse was like, you know, like Marlon Byrd and walking out and being a fake nice guy and all that kind of stuff. But Tony Campana is the first professional athlete I ever walked in on and saw him there in the clubhouse going, who's kid is that?
Right. That's not a professional athlete.
That is not. You are the same size as Adam Harris, and I just don't understand how you play professional baseball. This makes no sense to me.
He's Connor McKnight. I'm Dan Bernstein. Jeff Perlman, author of Note, he wrote Sweetness. He wrote Gunslinger, and he has just written a book called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. So if you're a Chicago Blitz fan, you'll want to hear
from
the always fascinating Jeff Perlman next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
ABC Sports presents the United States Football League Championship Game, 1985. The Oakland Invaders out of the West and the Baltimore Stars. The game is in the books. The Baltimore Stars have defeated the Oakland Invaders by a score of 28-24. And all the credit in the world to that young man right there, Jim Morris.
It was a thing. Those of us who may have attended a Chicago Blitz game remember it as a thing. And then it wasn't a thing anymore because somebody came in and ruined all of it. But the man who chronicled the league that he truly loved is Jeff Perlman, who is on Twitter at Jeff Perlman and joining the Bernstein and McKnight show. Well, Jeff, you finally went and did it. You finally are publishing your USFL book. It's great.
I just want to say the thing that is coolest about that intro you played, which was so cool, was if you listen,
The most 80s thing about it is he like, boom, boom, like the laser is going off.
Yes. So I didn't see the USFL. It's obviously before my time, but in listening to it and watching some film like on YouTube and stuff, all I can think, I think of American Gladiators. It's like that setup. It's that kind of spectacle thing. And I have to imagine that drew a lot of people to it when the NFL was like you talk about in the book, as boring as it was.
Well, I mean, all you got to do is look at the uniforms. If you do a quick Google search, like the uniforms are so good. Oklahoma Outlaws, Arizona Wranglers. I mean, the Michigan Panthers, one of their colors, listed colors for the uniforms, was champagne. To me, that in and of itself is just kind of badass.
One of my favorite all-time sports books is called Loose Balls by Terry Pluto.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an oral history of the American Basketball Association. And one comes away with the conclusion that the ABA, the wild and freewheeling ABA, kind of had it right in a way the NBA didn't understand. Forget all the business stuff and all the mishigas with Trump. But is there a way to draw a parallel here that some of what the USFL did with wide open passing offenses and risk taking is something that predicted more of the modern NFL than maybe that NFL even did?
Oh yeah, I mean I can tell you the kind of classic example for that is the Houston Gamblers with Jim Kelly was their quarterback. I mean they were so renegade and so outlaw that it was just way ahead of their time and. I mean, they got Jim Kelly. They literally got Jim Kelly. Jim Kelly had been drafted in 83 by the Bills, and he told the Bills, I do not want to play for you, but he felt like he had nowhere to go. He was in the Bills' offices with his agent negotiating a contract. George Allen was the general manager of the Chicago Blitz at the time. He was 25 years old. He called the Bills' offices because he found out Kelly was there, pretended to be a relative of his agent, and said he needed to speak to him because there was an emergency in the family. Got the agent on the phone. This is George Allen from the USFL. We know Jim doesn't want to play in Buffalo. Get out of there. We will make you happy. And Kelly and his agent are like, okay, we'll be leaving. They let him pick who he wanted to go to. He picked the Houston Gamblers. They bring in Mouse Davis to run the run and shoot, which was running at Portland State. And then they do this thing that is just – and it became a thing. They ended up finding all these like 5'8" wide receivers who could run like 4.3 40s. So you're talking about Ricky Sanders, who no one had ever heard of, Richard Johnson, never heard of, Gerald McNeil, Clarence Verdan. They brought all these guys in. They didn't even have – Jack Pardee was the head coach. He's like, we need a tight end. Mouse Davis is like, well, you can sign a tight end. They signed a tight end and released him 2 days later because they didn't use a tight end. There's just 4 and 5 wide receiver sets. And 2 years later, the Detroit Lions were running the same offense with some of the same players in the NFL. I mean, it changed – it just changed the way offenses were approached in football.
The name of the book is Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL.
How close, Jeff, was the USFL to doing what the AFL did before it, what the ABA did before it, and forcing the NFL to really reckon with it?
Oh, man, really good. The NFL was terrified. The NFL used to, in their offices, they would refer to the USFL as useless. And they would, you know, in public, they would say, oh, this thing. Gil Brandt once said maybe 12 players from the USFL can play in the NFL. It ended up being about 200, you know. There was, you know, the USFL, the NFL was seriously pondering the idea that we're going to have to absorb some of these teams because, you know, they're threatening us. They're stealing our players. It was scary. I mean, you have to remember they signed 3 straight Heisman Trophy winners. They signed Herschel Walker. They signed Mike Rozier. They signed Doug Flutie. They got Steve Young coming out of BYU. They got Jim Kelly coming out of Miami. They stole Doug Williams from the Buccaneers, Brian Sipe from the Cleveland Browns, on and on and on and on. It was an insane onslaught that the NFL actually did not see coming.
Let's talk about the elephant in the book, and that is obviously the presence of Donald Trump as the New Jersey Generals owner. And frankly, you know, not to boil it down sort of too bluntly, but the guy that ruined everything.
Now that you're going to say the elephant, let's talk about the elephant in the room. Vince Evans' season started for Chicago Blitz.
Right, Greg Landry of the Chicago Blitz and Tim Reitman. Now, but as you went on with this project and sort of the contemporal news drip that's going on, and as the book's being edited, Were you getting worried about political polarization? Were you concerned about what the reception's going to be? And obviously, it's important and it's timely, but maybe people want a sports book without constantly being reminded of everything else all the time. How do you balance what it says about him and what the obvious parallels are to things that are happening and things that matter today, with also the level of escapism you want in a rollicking sports book?
Yeah, it's really hard, actually. I've never promoted a book like this where you're talking, you know, I could go on your show and then 5 minutes later be on MSNBC, you know, and talking about Trump and his legacy. It's very, very hard. When I pitched the book, I was all about the USFL just because I love the league. When I got the book deal, it was before Donald Trump was president. And then I just decided you sort of have to own it. And the truth of the matter is he ruined the USFL. I'm not saying it would still be here thriving today if he had never been involved. It's hard to say. But he wanted an NFL franchise. The basic thing is he bought a year in. The USFL in 1983 had 12 teams. Heading into 84, the owner of the Generals was J. Walter Duncan. He wanted to sell. Donald Trump bought the New Jersey Generals. In the lead up to buying the team, he was all about the USFL. USFL is great. I love what they're doing. I love everything about this. I'm excited to be a part of it. As soon as he is the owner of the Generals, we need to move to fall. We need to take on the NFL directly. If God wanted football in the spring, he wouldn't have invented baseball. On and on and on. 1984, he holds a secret meeting with Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner, at the Pierre Hotel in New York. He pays for it, Donald Trump. And he says to Rozelle, I don't want to be in this league. I want an NFL team. You tell me what I need to do to get an NFL team. And he had tried buying the Baltimore Colts with no success in 1981. And Pete Rozelle says to him, as long as I'm involved in the NFL, as long as my family is involved in the NFL, you will have nothing to do with this league. Because he saw him as a con man and kind of a, you know, just a cheap suit and you know, new money. And so he didn't want him. So Trump was very persistent. And he thought, we're going to force our way in. And the best way we can do that is a lawsuit. And he convinced the other owners that we should move to fall, which is a horrible idea. He hired Roy Cohen as the league's attorney.
That's his guy. Yeah,
that's his guy, and famous for his McCarthyism ties through the years. And he said, he told the other owners straight up, if we hire Roy Cohen, the NFL is going to immediately want to settle because they're going to be so scared of us. That obviously didn't happen. And the lawsuit was held in New York, which was a huge mistake. Other owners were saying, I mean, at least if we're going to file this, file it somewhere where a jury will be more sympathetic to us than your home turf. But he didn't listen. He himself was the star witness. I interviewed one of the jurors in the trial who told me he was the worst witness she's ever seen in her life. That the USFL was supposed to be this underdog, and he made them the bully. And she told me the story. She said, he was trying to intimidate me from the stand. He was staring at me, trying to intimidate me from the stand. She said it was the worst witness she has ever seen in her life. And ultimately what happened is what the jury decided is, yes, the NFL was monopolizing TV, and that was the case. And yes, the NFL was trying to crush the USFL. But ultimately, what was ruining the USFL was Donald Trump and the ineptitude of the owners, and that's why the USFL won the case. They actually announced first that they won. And they're announcing all these, you know, all the sort of listings and how they won, and USFL people are going crazy. This is unbelievable. This is amazing. And then when they announced the $1 bill, that $1 award, Donald Trump was in the courtroom. The owner of the New York Giants was sitting next to him. He opened up his billfold and handed Donald Trump a dollar bill.
We're gonna have, Jeff, two leagues start relatively soon that will, in some way, go against the NFL, or in some way be maybe a developmental league. The XFL is one of them. Another, I can't remember the name of the other developmental league that may start. But are there lessons to be learned from this USFL league and its, you know, subsequent, you know, win in a lawsuit, but failure as a league and inviting Donald Trump into the ownership group? Are there lessons to be learned, or is it a different time and a different competitive market?
Well, I think the things the USFL did well, a league now can do well. Number one, spring. Number two, regional drafts. Like, the USFL had regional drafts, so the Tampa Bay Bandits were getting guys from Florida and Florida State, and you're drawing fans because fans feel connected to the players who they watched growing up in high school and college. I think the main thing the USFL did really
wrong or ill-advised is they just started going after the NFL really quickly and trying to steal their players. And if I were Spring League now, I would encourage my guys to wind up in the NFL. If I have a team in Boise or Omaha, and you can say, look, watch this team now. 2 years from now, your guy might be playing quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. Mm. I think that's pretty powerful, and the USFL certainly did not do that.
Jeff, best of luck with this. Certainly you can tell when an author has had a subject mean this much, how much passion comes through in how thorough this is and how the real emotion that's channeled through it. So it's a hell of a lot of fun, and we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Jeff Perlman, the author of Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL.
I'm through a little bit of it. And you're right. I mean, you could feel it right away. I mean, the prologue is a piece he wrote in high school, a 20-page yep. research piece or 40-page, whatever the hell it was. And it's just it feels – it's a fun one. It's just a really fun book to go through. I loved his book, The Bad Guys Won, about the 86 Mets.
Oh, Sweetness was fantastic. Sweetness. Remember the reaction to people in Chicago when he was telling the truth about Walter Payton and Mike Ditka said he walked across the street to spit on him
it
and
was.
All that?
Yeah, it was.
Well, we have the Midday Midway coming up. I've got Connor's favorite thing, a heist.
I love heists.
Yeah, you do.
We need more heists.
Yes, and this one is a wild and woolly one.
We're going to talk dingers, and we're going to talk about guys getting their due in a good way, too.
I have an update to a previous Midday Midway story about a battle on the high seas. It has been resolved.
The Midday Midway is next on 670 The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.